From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. Hollywood has given us a lot to talk about this week, and we will do just that later in the break room. Elijah Wood issues a warning to parents of child actors. Uma Thurman calls out men for just assuming that they're entitled to kiss women. And a pair of actresses say they want to turn at the role of the world's most famous secret agent.
Mr. Bond, bullets do not kill. It is the finger that pulls the trigger.
Exactly. I'm now aiming precisely at your groin. So speak over and above your peace.
That's all coming up this hour. But first, we buttered you up for a trip to the Biscuit Triangle on yesterday's show. That's what food writer Brad Kaplan calls the area north of Atlanta between Marietta and Kennesaw. It's home to some of the tastiest biscuit restaurants in the state.
And they're all in this little general vicinity, and I think it's kind of just special that you have this collection of biscuit shops that you wouldn't find in the city out here in this one general area.
And where do you find the best biscuits in Georgia? We asked, and here are your first thoughts. Catherine Napkina wrote us to say that the best biscuits are often right at home. Quote, biscuits are one of my few specialties, and in my family, we cannot have a celebration or holiday without homemade biscuits. I found a technique on the King Arthur Flour website. I'll point out here that King Arthur is a Vermont company, but anyway, she says, you make them, you freeze them hard on a baking tray, and then you put them into a container, then you bake them on high heat for 8 minutes, just straight out of the freezer, turn the oven off, and leave for another 8 minutes. Super trick for advanced biscuit prep. Well, we always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. Biologists have worked tirelessly to save bats from a deadly disease that is wiping out the animals up and down the eastern seaboard. But we now know those efforts have largely failed. A recent report shows that white nose syndrome, which made its way down to Georgia a couple of years ago, is continuing to spread. This devastating fungal disease could be killing bats across the entire United States in less than a decade. We last talked about white nose syndrome on this show back in March. Two wildlife experts join me to discuss how the disease evolved into an epidemic for bats and why that really does matter to humans. Chris Cornelson is a microbiologist at Georgia State University, and Heather Fenton is a wildlife pathologist for the Southeastern Cooperative Wildlife Disease Study. Here's that conversation. Chris, just tell us, what makes this fungus, this white nose syndrome, so particularly dangerous to bats?
Well, it's particularly dangerous to North American species, and specifically hibernating species. There's a couple of reasons why it's so damaging. One is that it's an invasive species. It was introduced in the United States somewhere in the mid-2000s, likely from Europe or more recently Asia. And so the bats in North America have not co-evolved with this pathogen. They have not lived in an ecosystem where this pathogen persisted, and so they have not developed natural defenses against it. Additionally, fungi are generally more virulent or devastating as pathogens because they are known to be saprophytic. That is, they can live in a habitat without the host on which they cause disease. So the pathogen that causes white nose syndrome will persist in caves when all the bats are wiped out. So there's no balance or counterbalance, if you will, to that pathogen burning through this population.
Yeah, you can't quell the outbreak by simply eliminating or culling a population. You'd have to go in and scrub the cave with Clorox or something, which obviously not going to be practical. Heather, remind us why we should care. Tell us a little bit about why bats are important to the ecosystem and to humans' involvement in the ecosystem.
Yeah, so as you mentioned before, they're incredibly important as pest control to the agricultural industry. So there's estimates that agricultural industries will have to use more pesticides if bat populations are eliminated, as well as they're really important pollinators for a number of crops. So they're doing this free service for us, and they're often maybe not thought of as doing this important service, but they're also important parts of the ecosystem in general. They're contributing to biodiversity. There's animals that eat bats, so owls, raccoons, skunks, and a number of other raptors like hawks will eat owls. Their poop, which is guano, is important to cave ecosystems. There's other microorganisms and then other animals sort of up the food chain that are really dependent on these ecosystems. So they're definitely an invaluable part to the ecosystem and to us. And there's some places where bats are obviously consuming insects, and insects can potentially carry pathogens that are harmful to people. So there's numerous ways where bats are important to us, even though we might not think about it.
Heather, how dire is the situation? White nose syndrome was first identified outside of Albany, New York. How bad has it impacted the bat populations in that epicenter?
Yeah, so there's a lot of folks that think that this is the worst or one of the worst wildlife diseases to hit North America. It's estimated that between 6 and 7 million bats have died from this fungus infection. There's caves where the mortality rate in each cave has been between 90 and 100% of those hibernating bat species that had lived in that cave. So there's been an extremely drastic reduction in bat numbers in affected areas, especially within the eastern North America.
And Chris, what's the situation looking like in Georgia? I mean, I remember it made rather minor news when white nose syndrome was first identified, I think, in North Georgia in 2013. I had recently moved to Georgia from Massachusetts, where the brown bat population has been decimated. So I noted that news item with great interest, and I thought, oh boy, what's been the result over the last two and a half years? How deeply has white nose syndrome impacted bat populations here in Georgia?
Unfortunately, Georgia has stuck with the trend we've seen throughout the East Coast. And recently, surveys are indicating that we're probably about 95% population declines in our most heavily affected species. And one example I can give you is recently I was able to go out with Department of Natural Resources to a survey to a site that historically was home to over 5,000 tricolor bats. During the survey, we counted a little over 200.
A little over, from 5,000 to 200.
Yeah, in 3 years.
That's stunning. So what makes this fungus so deadly? You touched on this earlier, but help me understand this a little bit more. In fact, let me play a clip here that's going to maybe give us a little bit of background. This is Craig Stiller of the West Virginia Department of Natural Resources, and he's talking about his opinion that as long as bats continue to hibernate, there will always be a risk of white nose syndrome. Let's listen.
Their body temperature's up, their immune system's going, they can fight off the fungus, but there doesn't seem to be any immunity. When they go back into hibernation again, they're just as likely to get white nose. And for as long as we have the right conditions, cold caves with hibernating bats, there doesn't seem to be anything that's gonna stop this from spreading.
So Heather, is that right? Is there really no way to break out of this cycle for the bats?
Yeah, I think it's definitely an active area of research. So one of the reasons is that it's affecting hibernating bats is because it's a psychrophilic fungus, so it's a cold-loving fungus. It does really well in cold and humid environments.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons why we think that maybe it's having this major impact. Another reason, as Chris has already mentioned, is that it is an introduced pathogen. So the thoughts are that bats within North America haven't had time to adapt to this fungus, like some bats have in Europe or Asia. So one of the other things that people should remember is that bat wings are incredibly important to bats. So we don't always think about how complicated physiologically their wings are, but they actually can breathe through their wings. They use their wings for temperature regulation as well as water balance, ion balance. So when there's a disruption of the wing membrane, which results from infection with this fungus, there's disruption in their water balance, so they become incredibly dehydrated. It's sort of similar to having really bad case of vomiting, of diarrhea in terms of the ion imbalance that happens.
Yeah.
And as well as just alterations in their metabolism in general. So what happens is that they wake up more often when they're hibernating, and then they're using energy stores and potentially emerging from caves before they're really supposed to. And then there's potentially no food around for them to be able to eat. So it's a really multifactorial process, and I think that's what's made it very complicated to try to understand, because it's not necessarily one thing that's going on. It's this multitude of factors.
We're talking to microbiologist Chris Cornelson and wildlife pathologist Heather Fenton about the spread of white nose syndrome into the southeast and into Georgia, where it is decimating bat populations that are vital to agriculture, among other aspects of ecological life. Chris, surely there are some responses underway, or at least in development, to save the bats. What are you guys working on?
Sure. There are a number of groups around the country working on management tools. And at Georgia State, we're working on a couple ourselves. And we've had some very positive preliminary results, and we're continuing to follow up with those with our partners and various federal agencies and state governments. As you mentioned earlier, the cave ecosystem, or the subterranean ecosystem these bats inhabit, is really unique. And so there's some additional concerns regarding development of tools. When you're talking about just scrubbing the cave with Clorox, right, that would be impractical, because we know that Clorox is sort of a broad-spectrum antimicrobial. It's going to have effects on all sorts of microorganisms and other organisms that inhabit these systems. So you don't want to disturb that ecosystem. So you want something that's very targeted towards this pathogen. And so that takes a little bit more creative thinking and a bit more of a challenge in the developmental stages. So a lot of
antifungal agent that you could introduce?
So there are some concepts that we're working on. For example, there are bacteria that are known to compete with fungi in the environment for resources. And at Georgia State, we're working on trying to leverage these naturally evolved systems to be applied in cave systems to target the pathogen, but hopefully have a less impact on the rest of the resident microflora in that cave. There's additional research into something like a vaccine, or the concept of gene silencing that's going on. But those are more theoretical at this point in regards to management of white nose syndrome, and a bit out on the horizon. So one of our goals in the immediate future is sort of stopgap management tools, because like we talked about, if you're having 95% declines in 3 years, you don't have a lot of time to develop some more sophisticated approaches, and by the time those more sophisticated tools become available, there may not be any bats left to treat. So our immediate goal right now is to try and scale up some initial management tools that can be used to prevent these massive population declines, with the goal of providing more time for these more long-term solutions to be developed.
Well, I appreciate the work that you both are doing, and our hopes are with you. Chris Cornelson is a microbiologist at Georgia State University. Heather Fenton is a wildlife pathologist for the Southeastern Cooperative Wildlife Disease Study. Thank you both so much, and good luck on this very important problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For more on white nose syndrome and how it affects bats, ecology, and agriculture in Georgia, visit gpbnews.org. This is On Second Thought.
It was dark outside, but the sun came in, renewed my mind, and let me in.
There's no shortage of music festivals in Georgia, especially once the weather heats up. One of the most popular ones returns to Atlanta this weekend. The Atlanta Jazz Festival takes over Piedmont Park through Sunday, and that gives us the perfect excuse to add a couple more tunes to the Georgia playlist. That is, when we ask people to choose two songs that they think best represent Georgia. The rules are simple. Nominations have to be songs written or performed by a Georgian, and musicians cannot nominate one of their own songs. This special edition of the Georgia Playlist features an artist who will be performing at this weekend's Atlanta Jazz Festival.
My name is Chandra Corelli, and I'm a singer. I live in Atlanta, Georgia. The first song that I want to talk about on the Georgia playlist is Love Don't Come Easy by Gene Karn. Gene Karn was born in Atlanta. Gene Karn has an incredible range, and not only his vocal range, but as far as music was concerned, because she went from one genre to another, which is the same thing I can say about myself. I like the mixture of jazz and R&B music, and so she was just one of those great examples for me as a singer to be able to stretch my taste in music and how all of them really relate.
Love me good.
first heard the song, Love Don't Come Easy, I was in high school. It was during the 70s. I relate to the song in the fact that, you know, love doesn't come easy. It's like, you know, it's like anything in life. You have to have something to compare it to. And so sometimes you have to have some really screwed up bad relationships to be able to, you know, see what the good ones look like. So I think I related to that, being a young person and being pretty occupied at that particular time with relationships. She used to sing with Roy Ayers in D.C. when he would come to town. And we were at a club called Blues Alley, and she came by. And I remember Roy Ayers saying to me, I was going like, it's Gene Kahn out there. She's going to be hearing me sing all these songs. And he was just like, I'd put you against anybody. Don't worry about Gene Kahn. You know, I was like, sure, sure. But knowing that she's a legend, it doesn't even matter. The next song that I want to talk about on the Georgia playlist is This Is a Man's World by James Brown. James Brown is originally from Augusta, Georgia. This is a man's world. This is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl. I picked It's a Man's World because it was just a very powerful statement back in the day when I was a little kid. And of course, I was used to James Brown singing, you know, really funky, up-tempo songs. And to hear him do a ballad so soulfully, it was one of those things that, you know, you would end up in the house singing, "It's a man's world." But the cap on it was, it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl.
But it wouldn't be nothing, nothing without a woman or a girl.
This is a man's world, and it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl. That was the lyric that got me. You know, and as a young girl, I really didn't get it, but I like the fact that I was included in my idol song. I was just like, that's one of my favorite songs. That's just one of my favorite sayings, that it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl. And so I think, like I said, whether or not he meant it or not, it was a great statement, and it was very uplifting for young girls like me. The sound of Georgia, it's a sweet soul. It's real. It's down to earth. It feels like home. That's the way it is in Georgia. It has guts to it, but at the same time, it has a gentleness, and it invites you into the park. And that's what I love about artists from Georgia. You can trust that they mean what they say. You gotta
face the fact. That was singer Chandra Carelli of Atlanta. She'll perform at the Atlanta Jazz Festival at Piedmont Park on Sunday at 6:30 p.m. Here's a taste of what you will hear if you're in the audience for that.
It's midnight, quiet visions in your mind, voices repeating.
Yeah, she's good. That's been a long week, and we took on some light topics like the fall of democracy, Atlanta's successful Super Bowl bid, and why Shakespeare's works are ripe for gender bending. So, as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It's time for the break room.
A man had to spend the night in jail and is now facing charges after his Star Wars hobby may have taken him to the dark side.
Bond. James Bond.
People are sick of seeing the same cookie-cutter character. Actor Gillian Anderson went viral this week after sharing a Photoshop someone made of her as Jane Bond.
So we named the ice cream Gundio Bar in the hopes that people get through the day well. It really helps to ease a hangover.
Oh, I'm sure it does. Joining me down in the Macon chapter of the Break Room is Charles Richardson, editorial page editor for The Telegraph in Macon. Hey, Charles.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Up in Atlanta, we've got Jeff Breedlove, communications director for DeKalb County Commissioner Nancy Jester. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good to be here.
Good to have you. We also have marketing and communications strategist Tamika DePriest. Hi, Tamika.
Good morning.
And finally, Robbie Medwed is an LGBT activist and educator in Atlanta. Happy Friday, Robbie.
Good morning. Happy Friday to you.
The NFL announced this week that the Super Bowl will come to Atlanta in 2019. Most people probably had one of two reactions to the news. Either you thought about how cool it would be for Georgia to host the big game.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Or you heard the sound of a traffic nightmare in your head. It's been nearly 20 years since the last time the city hosted the Super Bowl. Are we excited up there in Atlanta? Robbie, how are you feeling?
I think it's great. I'm really excited. Atlanta does large one-time events really, really well. It's the every single day, daily life stuff that we just can't seem to get together.
Charles, you going to go up?
Well, I can tell you, you know who you can thank for this happening? Governor Nathan Deal.
Yeah.
Because I can guarantee you, if that religious freedom bill had not been vetoed, the Super Bowl would not be coming to Atlanta, Georgia.
Well, there are other public officials, perhaps, who we can thank, if thank is the right word. Atlanta Falcons team owner Arthur Blank was a major part of the city's successful Super Bowl bid, and he spoke to the press after the announcement, and he said that other cities and other city officials should take notice of how Atlanta officials won the 2019 bid. Let's listen.
You know, the other owners, they realize that to build a stadium today is a huge capital investment. The league does its part to support it, but it requires a great public-private partnership to do it. And I think the message it also sends is to communities that are considering other NFL stadiums, or, you know, that this is going to be important in terms of Super Bowls.
So, Tamika, it seems to me that what Blank is really saying there is, hey, taxpayers paid for my team's new billion-dollar stadium, and now the NFL is going to reward said taxpayers by letting them host an event that most sports economists will say generates a tiny fraction of the revenue that the boosters always promise. Certainly nothing close to the stadium costs. Good trade?
You know, it's good PR, whether or not it's a good trade. You know, the jury's out on that, and in most instances, it is not. So I'm excited as a fan. I go to games now, and it'll be good PR for the city. But I have to admit, I am a little leery of the cost and, you know, the total return on investment and impact to the local economy. There'll be some, but not enough.
Jeff, is it worth it just for the fun of it?
Oh, no. No, it's not. I mean, everybody's been thanked except the taxpayers. This wouldn't have happened. This didn't happen because of Nathan Deal or Arthur Blank. It happened because of the taxpayers of Georgia. I think five of the last Super Bowls that have been rewarded have gone to cities that built new stadiums. And it's very clear from the NFL, if you want to host a Super Bowl, they're already dangling New Orleans. Roger Goodell wrote a letter to the owner of the Saints, which has been made public in the Times-Picayune. It's crystal clear. If you want to host a Super Bowl, you're going to pony up taxpayer dollars to build a billionaire a stadium. And that's a tragedy.
You know, the one thing that I wish Arthur Blank would build is a winning football team.
But
we could say that for all of Atlanta sports teams, really. Maybe not the Hawks, but pretty much everybody else.
Moving on, Congress has banned two words from being used in future federal legislation. Those two words are Negro and Oriental. I felt uncomfortable just saying them. President Obama signed the bill this week on the basis that those terms are outdated and offensive. This law also amends a couple of federal laws from the 70s that define minorities in those terms and changes them. Reaction, Charles?
Well, I honestly don't find Negro being offensive. Some variations of that word, yes.
Sure, yeah.
But I don't find it being offensive. I think that from time to time, terms do need to be updated. That's just the nature of the thing. Everything else is updated. But as far as the word Negro, I don't find offense to that at all.
Tamika, how are you feeling about this?
Well, quite the opposite. I actually applaud the president and Congress for bringing the language of these laws into modern times. And, you know, Negro, or all of that is outdated. So a little difference in opinion there for me.
No, we agree. I just don't, I'm not personally offended by Negro. I mean, once I was a Negro in my own community.
Yeah, but language changes, yes, and the implications, yeah, change over time. I did think it was funny. I saw somebody on my Twitter feed say, oh, there goes Obama again, regulating everything by edict, forgetting that this is something that, like, it's a rare thing that happened that's not an executive order. Like, Congress actually passed this. Like, the democratic process made this happen. Robbie, what are your thoughts?
I think it's a really great thing. I think it's a little absurd that we waited this long to get it done. But I'm glad that it happened. And it really is impressive that Congress could get together and agree on something.
Unanimous vote in the, yeah, House. All right, let's move on. We got some Hollywood topics I want to breeze through here. They're all pretty interesting, and they kind of connect to social justice in various ways. Let's talk about a fellow named Bond, James Bond. The secret agent character has been brought to life by some of Hollywood's biggest stars. You got your Pierce Brosnan, your Daniel Craig, and Sean Connery. They all have something in common, don't they?
Do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Yeah, everybody who has played Bond has faced death and also been a dude. But when asked recently whether she would like to play a Bond girl, actress Priyanka Chopra said, F that, I want to be Bond. Tamika, great answer or the greatest answer?
Well, I love it. And, you know, even though I'm still swooning over the idea of Idris Elba as Bond, I could see Kerry Washington or Angelina Jolie as Bond.
Yeah, we've got a Facebook commenter, Clay Teague, says Kerry Washington would be a better choice than Gillian Anderson, who I should say is the actress from The X-Files, who has also hinted that she would be potentially interested in the role of Jane Bond, or however you want to modify this. Jeff, strong feelings on whether a woman could play James Bond or something approximating James Bond?
Well, I don't know if it's a strong feeling, but I have an opinion. And that is that, you know, the brilliance of that franchise is that James Bond was 007. And there's no limit on the number of 00s you can have. And I've always thought that franchise should introduce other 00s.
Ah, you're saying it could just be a different agent in the same unit.
I mean, James Bond happens to be a white British guy. And they've made millions of dollars, and fans of all demographics have flocked
to see. Hold on a second. James Bond is made up. So he can be whoever we want him to be.
No, the author, the creator of James Bond created the character a certain way.
Oh, but, yeah, because we never change books when we turn them into movies.
I'm just saying that I think the way to go would be to introduce in their own right other 00 characters that people embrace and have all kinds of diversity in the 00 universe.
Let's whip through a couple more of these Hollywood topics real quick. Moving on to dangers for child stars. Most people know actor Elijah Wood for playing Frodo Baggins, hero of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. That's a book they changed a lot for the movie. He got a start in Hollywood at a very young age. Here he is opposite Macaulay Culkin in the 1993 film The Good Son.
Sooner or later, they're going to find out about you.
Who's they? My dad? My mom?
I told your mom.
Why would she believe you? She's my mom, not yours.
You know, you're wrong about that. She is my mother.
Your mom? You crazy? Your mom's maggot food.
Hollywood can be brutal for some child stars. Elijah Wood recently talked about the problem of child actors falling victim to abuse in an interview with the Sunday Times in the UK. He later clarified in a tweet that he has no firsthand experience of that kind of abuse, but that was something that got a lot of people's attention. Raised a lot of eyebrows when he kind of tweeted recently that Hollywood can be a very dangerous place for young actors, and then he kind of had to clean it up and say, actually, I didn't encounter any abuse, but here's somebody who did. Here's Corey Feldman from the 80s speaking about his 14th birthday with talk show host Wendy Williams.
There were four or five of them circled around us like vultures, and every single one of them is either a convicted or theoretical pedophile. Okay? Four or five of them.
Would they dope you up, get you high or drunk, and then have
That's
their way
the
with you?
That's the name of the game. That's the name of the game. Hey.
So let's talk about this, Robbie. The entertainment industry is one of the few businesses where kids under 14 are allowed to work at all in this country. Is it really possible to protect them in that environment?
I think it definitely can be, but we have to have a separate system of somebody who's a manager and then somebody who's actually just a child advocate to make sure that the child's interests are actually kept at heart and not just the business interests. It's really not uncommon for people to just put their trust and their faith in somebody who's making money off of them.
Can I comment on that?
Sure.
That advocate, in many cases, should be the parent. I mean, I'm wondering where the parents are in this process. And it's really disappointing. Of course, these children are the victims. And my last quick comment on this, and take it with a good nature, is, you know, Hollywood is known as a liberal or progressive community, and they're getting into a lot of bad PR stuff with controversy over race and the Oscars and now this. And I think our friends on the left in Hollywood need to get their act together.
I'm not sure how on the left they really are, though. That's the problem. I think we think that they are, but then we see all these issues with race and all this other kind of stuff that's being swept under the rug. They're not so liberal when it comes down to it.
Yeah, and, you know, Hollywood is a microcosm of the larger, you know, landscape and universe that we live in. And actually, Jeff, when you raised the question about parents, it made me think about the number of parents who actually give up their careers to sort of walk that journey with their kids as it relates
to
their
as a result, they have a really big financial stake in their kids' success, and that's why maybe they're not in the position to be the most effective advocate, right?
And I think they also probably blindly fall into the idea of the fame and the money, and they don't even realize who they're putting their faith in. It probably would be really great to have somebody who's experienced in the industry who actually isn't financially benefiting from everything.
But see, that's interesting because I have a teenage son, and he plays football, and he's not bad at it. And I have to
talk about
you,
a hazardous pursuit.
He's the kicker, so it's pretty good.
Okay.
But in all seriousness, I mean, we make a lot of sacrifices to make sure we're around and near him, and we give up a lot of time with our adult friends on weekends. We give up a lot of work time. We've made concessions at work to be able to make sure we're aware of his surroundings. And if a parent has, and I think most of the parents we're talking about here are in a position to be around it, the minute you put the financial success of your child ahead of your child's safety, you have done your child a disservice.
Charles, would you let your grandkids be actors?
Only if I'm standing about 3 inches from them. The thing is, you have to remember, Hollywood is a dangerous place for adults. Mm-hmm. You know it's going to be a dangerous place for children. That's just the nature of the industry. You've got relationships that last nanoseconds, marriages that last from, you know, really one moment to the next. It's dangerous for the Cardassians, much less a child that hasn't fully developed yet.
Yeah.
So you have to, if you're a parent, you have to watch your child like a hawk at all times. If you are in Hollywood, or if you're in Atlanta, Georgia, or if you're in Macon, Georgia, or anywhere else, you have to watch your children like a hawk.
Well, speaking of dangers for adults, one more Hollywood topic in the break room today. A Hollywood star who felt violated, Uma Thurman. Listen to what happened during a gala event in France. Thurman was doing a charity auction. The winner of that particular auction that she was auctioning or adjudicating or whatever you call it was this Italian guy who's the heir to the Fiat fortune, Lapo Elkann. He won. He marched up visibly inebriated and gave Thurman a kiss. And I mean a kiss, a big open mouth kiss. A representative for Uma Thurman later said that the kiss was, quote, opportunism at its worst, and that, quote, Thurman is very unhappy that this happened to her and she feels violated. So the question is this sexual harassment or is Uma Thurman maybe overreacting? Tamika, I feel like there are circumstances in which I, as a guy, would feel like it would be appropriate for me to at least peck a woman on the cheek or do the hand around the shoulders? Or is should really you kind of look for inviting social cues before you do any of those kinds of things?
Well, I think it's important to look for the invitation. I mean, I'm from that school of no means no. But that being said, I think the structure of the event itself was problematic, right? There were no handlers on stage. I mean, we're talking about a celebrity auction. There should have been some mechanisms for sort of coordinating and facilitating interactions, and she was simply out there and as such found herself in this awkward position, and that kind of surprised me because celebrities generally have some tight protocols around these types of things. And so,
and if he was visibly intoxicated, that sounds like a problem that security also really should have taken
first
care
problem.
Of before letting him up on stage.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
I was
without
thinking,
a doubt.
Where's the security involved in this? I mean, it's Italy, so things are different. But in all seriousness, where was her security detail?
And I don't want to fault her for feeling violated. I think she's absolutely justified in feeling violated and that it was a very inappropriate thing. I think there's a whole failure of systems that weren't really in place that led to this.
Then again, a lot of people have pointed to pictures of this event taking place, and Thurman doesn't look thrilled about what's happening, but she actually does some things that could be interpreted as physical reciprocation. She sort of puts his hand up on his cheek and is smiling. Now, we all know that people do that even when they feel incredibly uncomfortable with situations that they're trying to cope with it, but that should that affect, Charles, how we examine this?
Well, I think the first thing, he's probably quite lucky because she could have put her hand upside his cheek in a very different way and probably should have. And I think she probably showed an amazing amount of restraint to keep from slapping his face. I think she just dealt with the situation, didn't embarrass him or herself, and got through it.
Yeah, above all, she knows she was on stage and there were hundreds of thousands of cameras and people watching that moment.
Yeah, he obviously didn't understand that because, one, he was drunk.
Yeah, and, you know, when you're heir to a fiat fortune, I guess just nothing really matters in life. But anywho, let's move on to some things that are perhaps a little bit more substantive. Students at Yale University have submitted a petition for their school to abolish the major English poets major. And the students also want the pre-18th, 19th century lit requirements to include literature related to gender, race, sexuality, ableism, and ethnicity. And also, oh yeah, some writers who weren't white guys. So the question is, should Yale dump Chaucer or Pope or T.S. Eliot or somebody in order to make room for some other authors? Robbie, you have strong feelings on this one?
I do, and I'm probably the most liberal person on the panel today, and I think there's still great value in all these English writers. I think that there's no reason why we can't have more classes and more opportunities to read other people at the same time. I know when I was in school, we had required numbers of English classes, not required types of English classes we had to choose, and they were all organized by writers from this period and this area and this viewpoint so that we could mix and match and learn from all different types.
Yeah, but okay, I'll tell you from, you know, being on the faculty of Mercer University here in Macon, we deal with this all the time where people say, hey, you need to teach students this thing that you haven't taught them before, and that's awesome, but you can't just keep adding to the plate. At some point, you got to start taking things off that plate. Otherwise, there's just too much for people to get through in 4 years. So, Tamika, do you think it's worth rejiggering the canon to try to make it more inclusive, even if that means having to take away some really, really strong and important work?
Yes. And I was an English major, but at my alma mater, Spelman College, and so I got to explore Baldwin and Angelou and Shakespeare and, you know. And so I think because we do live in an increasingly diverse world, that there is a place to shuffle some things around. So maybe you are giving me, you know, Shakespeare and Sonia Sanchez, and maybe I have to, you know, get T.S. Eliot later. It could be at the bottom of the syllabus as a reference. I think there's a way to do it, and I think it's important to expand horizons, important to be more diverse.
Well, you know, one thing we have a continuation of time of civilization. You see people and writers in their context of their time and their life and how people followed them and continued through time. And I think that's important for students to learn, at least know that they're there.
Sure.
And that way you see how we have moved through this civilization, how we've gotten better, sometimes how we've gotten worse. And the only way we can know that is to study that.
On the other hand, Jeff, you know, those dead white guys that are conventionally studied in college English classes, you know, it is unjust that only their voices came to us through the centuries and not the voices of all of the other people who were writing but weren't socially privileged enough to have their work published or preserved. That said, it is their work that has come down through the ages to us, and it is their work that has informed how people write today. So don't we have to study literature and the history of literature as it is rather than how we wish it were?
Well, I kind of agree with Robbie on this. I mean, one of the reasons why Yale is Yale, why it has the reputation, is based on the historical teachings and foundations of education they put in place. So we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You need to, I think, use technology and raise the bar, offer more authors, but don't destroy the foundations that have made things the way we are. But the real problem here, it's great that students are speaking up. I mean, many of them pay for their education. They have every right to participate. But who's letting the students down are the faculty and administration at these major universities who are just... they're not leading, and they're caving in. You cannot let the inmates run the asylum here. You have to have adults who make a lot of money put together a curriculum that serves today's students. And I don't think that's happening, and I think the victims are the parents that pay for it and the students that pay for it and the foundations that provide these scholarships. And they need an education that satisfies students today. But that needs to come from these chancellors that are making an awful lot of money in these states.
I think it's important to note, as we think about historical perspective, that we think about the lens through which we explore that. And so when we talk about Shakespeare, Chaucer, and, you know, their connection to, you know, literature and the canon, we have to think more broadly and globally and include, you know, a broader perspective in terms of how we approach that. And so I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay. Well, we are talking about the week's news here on The Break Room on Second Thought, Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm Adam Ragusea. We're here with Jeff Charles, Tamika, and Robbie. And we want to thank Savannah Coffee Roasters for donating the coffee that is fueling our Break Room guests this morning. Savannah Coffee Roasters is online at savannahcoffee.com. Let's take a trip to a galaxy far, far away. Not that far, but about 50 miles from Atlanta lies a small town of Newbourne in Newton County. Justin Marling spent a night in jail there after he walked outside dressed up as a Star Wars stormtrooper. Marling was doing this, he says, to raise money for charity, but apparently it raised a few alarms. He was wearing the traditional Imperial armor and holding a toy blaster when he was stopped by police. He was arrested for reckless conduct and for wearing a mask. Georgia law says that masks are not allowed unless it's for a holiday or for a function. Marling told WMAZ-TV that he has been stopped before.
Military police arrested me, but they didn't charge me with anything.
So are your days of stormtroopering over?
No. Absolutely not. Like, as long as there's Comic-Con conventions or anything like that, I'm a stormtrooper for hire.
Okay, so Charles, does the punishment fit the crime here?
Where's Barney Fife when you need him? Where is he? You know, we can fire off fireworks in your yard or in a park or whatever and blow up things. But here's a guy that walks around in a costume that's 35 years old, basically.
Yeah.
A stormtrooper that in one of the most successful movie franchises that the world has ever seen. And he gets arrested and has to spend the night in jail.
So it's hilarious, but there is a real serious, historical reason behind this Georgia law that says no masks, right?
But there's no pointy head on his mask.
Robbie, why don't you explain that?
Yeah, this law came about because the folks in Georgia didn't want the Klan being able to stay anonymous. So they couldn't wear their masks when they would go out on their raids and burn their crosses and everything. And I think it's pretty clear that a stormtrooper is not a member of the Klan, and that's a pretty obvious thing. And I don't think that the punishment fit the crime at all.
Well, it did fit the crime because if you read local accounts from the police officer's side of the story, this man would have never been arrested had he done the following. He was approached by the officers not once, not twice, but three times, And on three occasions, he failed to comply with lawful directives by the police. He failed to drop the weapon. He failed to remove the mask. Now, we hold police officers to a very high standard, and there's been incidences where there's been mass murder. Those officers did not know if that gun was real or not. And if that man had killed somebody with a gun like that, the story today would be, how did police officers let a guy walk down the street in the middle of a city and blow people away? So he would not have, the officer said, the reason why they took the action they took was he failed to comply with lawful orders to make sure safety was being done. This guy was a jerk.
Yeah.
He got what he deserved, and thank God no one died because of his actions and no officer was hurt.
Thank you very much for ruining our fun. But as we approach the weekend, let's just plan ahead a little bit. Listeners, how do you cure the common hangover?
Hey, Lenny, remember we used to come here in high school late night after we got wasted?
What's wasted?
Wasted, kids, is when you have a hankering for ice cream.
Okay. So a convenience store chain in South Korea has launched an ice cream bar that they say can help fight hangovers. It's grapefruit flavored and has a percentage of oriental raisin tree fruit juice. So, of course, it's going to help with your hangover. Not so sure about that. We're out of time. But listeners, let us know how that works for you, or if you have a better idea for how to fight a hangover. Jeff Breedlove, Charles Richardson, Tamika DePriest, and Robbie Medwitt. It was great having you in the break room. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks, y'all.
Have a good weekend.
Be good.
And listeners, we'd love to hear from you about your hangovers this weekend. Call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk. That's on Second Thought. Celeste Headley's back at you next week. I'm Adam Ragusa. Have a good one.